gentlemen.
This is Bad Advice.
Hey folks, welcome to this week's edition of Robot Radio. Got a big show lined up. This would be a Wednesday edition. This would be the Thursday edition. A little bit early this week. I got some stuff that I lined up earlier this week that I can't wait till the weekend to get out. Got a ton of stuff lined up. We've got some tunes from Mara, Kevin McVicker, Deaths from Above, a great local indie band here in Toronto. All great tunes. I'd really recommend it, that after you hear these tracks, you go out, find the ones that you like and try and give these artists some support. Good fun stuff, anyway. There's been a ton of talk this week, actually, about podcasting and RIA and indie music, or as Adam Curry likes to call it, great shit, good fun music. Yeah, he said a couple of times. But you know what? He's absolutely right. This is, you know, who cares about the RIA or whether it's called indie music or whatever? This is like, love the music and share it with your listeners and be original and have fun with it. And you know, hopefully, my excitement about some of these tunes really comes through, and you know, you go out and find these guys. You'll notice last week I started putting links to the homepages for these artists in the RSS file. So, and hopefully, that makes it a little bit easier for you. No Robot Radio this week. Robots are on strike. They walked out. Way out. They just, like, mumbled something about less pay and more hockey or something like that. So in scrambled. And pulled a little bit of an old idea out of the old hat, and resurrected something that a buddy of mine and I came up with in the late 90s. It was late-night trash talk is what it was. We came up with this amazingly great idea after, like, way too many beers. It was just a real simple idea, though. We're going to move down to the valley, we're going to party a lot, and we're going to sell our business plans to those unsuspecting and unwitting venture capitalists. And even after having a bunch of beer in us, we figured that 90% of the stuff we couldn't remember the next day was probably better than 90% of the stuff that was getting funding at the time. Even though we were probably right, it was really just us trash talking about stupid ideas, about stupid things that we knew nothing about. Anyway, so I figured, hey, no robots this week, so why not resurrect the idea and turn it into a segment? So Doug and I got together on Tuesday night, that's two nights ago now, we talked for like, geez, an hour and a half, and this is the result of that. Unfortunately, the recording technology that I used wasn't that great, and I got to figure out a better way to do it. So I did doctor it a little bit and took a lot of the noise out of the equation, tried to boost some of the bass and bring down some of the highs. But hopefully it's listenable. I'd love to get feedback on that. That's something I want to work on. Or if you have any better ideas for recording phone conversations using Windows, I understand for the Mac it's real easy. With the Line-In Recorder, you can use Skype or other VoIP technologies. I just want to use a regular phone because that makes it a lot more portable for me. So if you've got any ideas, let me know. Before we get into Two Drunk Marketing Guys, I found this great track by a group called Mara. Liking it a lot. It's an amazing track, actually. I think if I'm going to keep finding stuff like this or the Panachronic that I played on the weekend, I'll probably have to do a greatest hits show soon or something like that. But anyways, this is Mara. The track's called Freedom Park. Enjoy yourself. Reflections in the room.
Love be there. light shine down. Oh, yeah, let your light shine down. Oh, come on and shine. Heaven's little light is gonna shine on me. Yeah, yeah, I say, yeah. Heaven's little light is gonna shine on me. Shine, yeah, yeah, shine on me. Yeah, yeah, shine, yeah, yeah. Come on and shine.
First one just absolutely kills me every time. We had was Nashville by Guitarcenal. Kevin McVicker doing a little bit of Collective Soul with his cover of Shine, and kicking it off with Freedom Park. Love that song, love that song, love that song, love that song. Cannot stress that. It's just a good, fun track. Anyways, I'm going to drop off here because this show is going to be long enough as it is. I'm going to leave you with a good solid hour of Two Drunk Marketing Guys. Be back in a bit. We'll play a couple of tunes, listen to more Two Drunk Marketing Guys, and then kick it off with even more tunes after that. So, like I said, it's packed. Hopefully, it's informative and definitely a little bit of fun in there.
Welcome to the new feature called Two Drunk Marketing Guys. One of the drunk marketing guys, well, neither of the drunk marketing guys are the drunk marketing guys. Well, that's more dorm. But I'm here with Doug McDonald. Say hi, Doug.
Hello, sir. I would take the. I'm working on getting drunk. Anyway.
So, Two Drunk Marketing Guys. Where did the. Where did we come up with that one?
Came up with it on one of the all too frequent evenings when we actually were Two Drunk Marketing Guys. Back, I don't know, anywhere from 5 to 6, 7, 8 years ago, depending on when we want to start this saga.
Exactly. The whole purpose of this little segment is basically to recreate the high points of that and talk shit about stuff we know nothing about, but sound good doing, hopefully. Anyway, maybe anybody out there listening agrees or disagrees, they can write in or call in, or I don't know, doing a podcast, podcasting, I guess that would be the best way to do it. But so we got some stuff we want to talk about today. TLDs, broadband over power. What else we got lined up, Doug? Stuff about Akamai.
Google's latest foray into our lives. The Cheap Bastard's Guide to Technical Trade Shows, the classic. So we got to spend some time on that for sure.
Perfect. New TLDs. Big problem. Did you see ICANN's announcement today? Did you actually read that?
Actually read it, no. Did I see it? Yes.
Okay, I'll
read it, obviously.
The whole point of this was ICANN sent an announcement today saying that they put together some resources to help the community have a dialogue about accepting the new, longer TLDs in a better sense than they have been. By that, I mean making sure that all of the shopping carts and this and that, and the other thing, all those little bits that make everything stick together. Make sure that this stuff works. So when you type in .museum, it doesn't spit back a, what do you mean .museum? That's not a TLD. There's only 5 TLDs. Com.org, BizInfo, blah, 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 blah. So what do you think? Is this just something that this really needs to be dealt with by ISPs and software developers, or is this just a bunch of registries suffering the consequences of bad choices when they pick their string?
I think the real problem with the new TLDs is actually exemplified by the opening part of this, by which you had read it and cared about it, and I had glanced at it, and that was it.
Sure.
I think new I know from firsthand experience that new TLDs and CCTLDs, the biggest challenge facing them is just gaining acceptance in the registrar community, let alone the general public. The general public is far less interested in anything new. They're far more interested in maximizing what they've got, is my understanding.
What do you mean firsthand? Like,
I have clients who are involved in the registry space.
Right.
And I know firsthand from doing some sales work with on their behalf and working with them to try and expand their reach that people aren't buying easily. What I also know is from the other side of my business and doing small business research and working with small businesses is that they're still trying to figure out how to make .com work. They're an awful lot less interested in other things than just can I make my .com that I've had for 4 years now, actually start returning something on me, whatever it is that they spend on it.
So by that logic, then, new TLDs of any stripe, whether they're two, three, or 20 characters, just doesn't matter one bit. People don't care.
If nobody goes to them, it doesn't matter if they're one character. It doesn't matter if they automatically pop up. People aren't looking for something new. They're looking to make what they've already got work. The vast majority, I think that both of us are guilty of this, in that we work at the bleeding edge, to use an old term, but I mean to always be looking for something new and forgetting, for a second that, maybe our dads know about .info and .biz, but do they even know that .museum exists?
Yeah, sure. Sure, does it matter if he knows, though? Or my dad knows, not to pick on your dad. He's a nice man. I like him a lot, for the record.
I can personally, with 99% certainty, guarantee you my dad doesn't know .museum exists.
Right, but does that matter? Right.
It doesn't matter. Does it matter to my dad what exists beyond .com, .net, .org, .ca? Not a lot.
.biz,
the fact that he knows that .info and .biz exist, that's good for him, too.
Yeah.
Maybe that expands it.
Yeah.
He's far more interested in what comes up when he types it into, the search engine of his choice, whether it be Google or Yahoo or whatever.
But there's, a million .infos out there? Something like that now?
It's over that.
Yeah, so that's a good number. So it's not like these things are just sitting around empty. People are actually using them, so it's not, certainly I wouldn't want to leave anybody with the impression that it's just, InfoBiz, et cetera, just not getting used, because it's certainly getting used.
But, I mean, relative to the frequency with which they come top of mind, my Google search starts before I ever type of google.com, which is type in whatever I'm looking for.com.
Right.
So it comes up.
Right. So back to this announcement, does the 1 million infos or whatever the big number is, does that change to 2 million or 3 million once ISPs actually start accepting this in their validation software and software developers actually, start doing some serious validation checking, or is it just, it is what it is, and this is just squeezing out some marginal, some incremental growth?
I really don't think that ISPs are ever going to be in the business of filtering the content to their provider, to their customers, unless they've specifically been asked to, because there's just way too many legal ramifications to not be incurred.
Yeah.
I think this is an issue for the marketing folks at new registries, whether they be GTLDs or CCTLDs, and honestly, at registrars, getting the word out to ensure that their resellers and users know about a new TLD.
Right. Yeah, no, I'd buy that.
This is a mind-based thing, not a technical-based thing.
I think I concur with that. I've always struggled with why this is an ISP issue. It's not like ISPs are out there writing proxy server software, or writing shopping cart software, or writing whatever. By and large, they're going to fresh meat, downloading something, or they're doing a deal with a company like Two Cows and outsourcing it or whatever. But there's all the exceptions to this, but they're generally not writing software. They're looking at whether it's two, three, or four characters. So I'm still trying to figure out what the connection is. But anyways, maybe the mailing list and the outreach that they're doing will shed some light on it for everybody.
Let's hope.
Now I've lost my notes here. Can you believe that? There we go. Broadband over power. Thumbs up or thumbs down? What do you think?
Honestly, I think thumbs down. I don't see this. I don't see this as a major. It's a major threat to anybody. I see it as an opportunity for a few. Now, if we change that to Ethernet over power line, that becomes a different equation, but comes with a different set of technical challenges in terms of allowing the existing power infrastructure in your house to become your Ethernet, or the even better.
Okay, so that distinction is almost lost on me. I think I hear you talking about the local network opportunity versus the wide area network opportunity, right?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, I see BPL as a land piece if it's going to, you know, really make any kind of dent. You know, BPL is touted as sort of a rural opportunity.
Right.
Well, you know, DSL just doesn't work out to that length. We don't have cable in the vast majority of, you know, whether it be Winnipeg or Manitoba, most of Saskatchewan does not have cable, and almost none of Montana outside of, you know, rather metropolitan areas really have cable.
Sure, sure.
So, but they don't have power, so right. We can get, you know, at least 1 meg to them over the power line. Well, how many of these people really need a meg?
Can you actually get that kind of distribution out of it? Like, can you actually push Ethernet over those kinds of distances, though? I mean, not Ethernet, but can you actually push packets over those kinds of distances, or is it like DSL where you condition the line, it's good for a quarter mile or a mile or 3 miles in some instances, but generally you're not going to push it out 15 miles outside of Mount to a guy's camp?
See, I think it's, I mean, trust me, I've never been accused of being a genius, let alone a technical genius.
Yeah, just remember, this is us talking about stuff we don't know anything about, right? So
it's my understanding that, you know, this is not looked at as a long-haul solution.
Right.
This is looked at as a last longer than a mile solution.
And so even in
it's not something that runs 25 miles back to the farmhouse, you know, someplace in Texas where it's 25 miles
right,
to the
right.
length from the pavement to the house. This is something that is looked at as, you know, a 3 to 4 to 5 mile solution, you know, or opportunity at the very least, where wireless just doesn't fit.
So that's not going to help these guys in Montana, then.
It's really, I mean, it's not going to help an awful lot of people.
Right. It's really competing in those metropolitan markets for the guys that already have DSL. They already have cable. They already have something. And the power companies are expecting to walk in and walk away with it.
Where I can see BPL really making, you know, some waves, or at the very least making life easier for some people, making some money for power companies, is when you get into a situation where, you know, you're servicing a company that owns the building.
Sure.
You know, we can deliver, you know, fiber to the curb because we have it there already. It's a part of our existing infrastructure. And just wire the rest of your building so that every socket theoretically could become an Ethernet.
Right.
And we just give you a, instead of an RJ45 jack, we, you know, give you a pluggable RJ45 jack.
So let me try this on for you here. Mark Evans, got a weblog at evans.blogware.com. Quote: if electrical utilities decide to get in the broadband power line game, it will no doubt mean reduced consumer prices and fewer customers for carriers and cable companies. Now, this guy isn't just some random Joe blogger talking shit about stuff he doesn't know about, like you and I, for instance. You know, he's a respected columnist for a big Canadian newspaper that deals with telcos all the time. So he's saying that if these guys get into the game, it's going to be more competition, it's going to be better price, better service for consumers.
Absolutely.
Do you buy it, really?
Oh, no. I don't doubt it for a minute. Do I believe that anybody can make money at the pricing that it will create? No, I don't honestly believe.
Come on. You think it's going to reduce our broadband price? You're paying, what, $50 a month for your connection?
Sure. But will...
Really?
Well, I mean, to use Canadian dollars, you know, our house is built. That's the thing. For those who don't know, my wife and I have two houses. We have one here in Pennsylvania, and we have one in Canada, in Oakville, Ontario. And in the house in Oakville, Ontario, it costs, you know, what is it? I think it's 40. I'm not even sure for Christ's sake. I think it's $45.95 is the portion of the cable bill that is dedicated to the internet piece. I mean, it's a 3 meg internet connection. If I were to get a 3 meg internet connection from Oakville Hydro, can I get it for $45 a month? I'm certain. I guarantee you they will charge me less than $45.
So?
They charge me less than $30 a month.
I don't buy that. I don't buy it. So you've got first guys in the door was with Bell, or you know, the phone company. They were charging them $50 a month. Second guys in the game, the cable company, charged $50 a month. Do you think the third guy in the game, because we're not talking about guys 3 through 15 coming into the market, we're talking about the third man in. I wouldn't drop my prices.
They'll drop their prices to get market share, because it's not like the people in the in the country that can afford $50 a month for internet that aren't paying it already. How many of them can't get it, really? You add those numbers up, there's not that many. The other thing is that look at the technical infrastructure that these guys have to put in place to service this need.
Yeah, but so what? So we've got 50% of the Canadian population that's online with broadband. You've got 30% of the U.S. population that's online with broadband. You think it's absolutely necessary to come in and undercut the existing players to actually get market share?
No, but their introductory offer will be less than what it is for everything.
Fair enough. I'd buy that.
Absolutely.
I'd buy that.
And even when I'm here, I don't know the economics of it, you know, just because I don't know.
But pretend you do and talk about it. That's the whole purpose of the show.
I don't believe that they can make money at $50. I really don't.
Don't think so? Okay. I have no idea of what the infrastructure even looks like. So.
I have an idea of what it looks like, but I really don't know what it would cost. But I just also know that when it costs you, you know, $40 an hour to get anything done on a Sunday, even internally, you know, at your local utilities, you know, how on earth are you ever going to get a service call in? How are you going to take care of technical service on a Sunday? When you have to pay your employees $40 an hour.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm.
You cannot make money doing that. And, you know, I'm at the risk of sounding like a union basher, there's no way that any utility company with a union base can handle it unless they outsource it. But, you know, anybody that outsources it just ends up biting them in the butt anyway.
Right, 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 right. So on that note, let's cue up a track from Death from Above, 1979. And when we get back, we've got a couple more topics to cover up. We've got a little bit on Apple, the Indian new broadband policy that they brought in India. A little bit about the Akamai Vidara news, and of course the Cheap Bastard Guide to Technical Trade Show. I'm Ross. I'm with Doug. Two Drunk Marketing Guys. We'll be right back. Why I'm sent away in the basement is where I'm gonna stay. There is pride in all the things I say. Will you hate me if I stay this way? From the bedroom where we're running from, there's a sequel to the things I've done. You're a woman, we will know it's true. You we're back, Mr. Douglas. So I just find this whole YouTube Apple thing one of the, I'm not sure, the weirdest marketing thing or the most brilliant. It's probably both, but from a marketing perspective that I've ever seen. You've got Apple going out and pushing their new iPod, quote-unquote, platform. I hate that term. Pushing their iPod platform with all sorts of great tunes and great commercials on primetime TV. And they're making stars out of these relatively unknown bands that they're using in the commercial. So a year later now, you've got YouTube buying time through some sort of arrangement that they've got with Apple to actually get their new single featured in the commercial. So you've, in essence, got somebody buying advertising time in an advertisement. It's just like some sort of universal law of recursion that violates. I'm not sure, but what do you think?
I just think to myself, who's the most desperate to sell something at that point in time? You know, I'm betting that, 30 months ago not knowing the chronology, at the very birth of the iPod,
yeah,
would they have been able to, for any amount of money, been able to sign YouTube to endorse digital music?
Sure.
No. Now, YouTube is, bringing them off the hook, saying, how much will it take for you to make us one of them commercials? And, oh, by the way, the rumor has it anyway. Oh, and by the way, we'd like to give away a whole bunch of albums preloaded onto iPods. And, we'll even give them the CD. Just let us make this commercial because you're so much more popular than we are right now.
I heard that today. Now, catch this first stat. You've got rumors of preloaded content going on iPods. In October, they're expecting to sell a million of these things. Same thing in November, same thing in December, same thing going into January, February, March, April. A million iPods a month, which means that, over a 90-day period, you've got enough album throughput just on those devices alone to actually make serious chart success. So is it beyond the tipping point? Is this where digital music is officially institutionalized as something that will be around forever? Not debating that it won't be around forever, but is this what takes it to the absolute mainstream?
But, just think about it this way. Assume that you find someone. It doesn't matter. It could be Doug and Ross on harmonica for the months of October, November, and December. We're triple platinum by Christmas, buddy.
Yeah, exactly.
We're triple platinum album sellers by Christmas.
Amazing. I would love to see this come through. You remember the original Rip, Mix, and Burn commercials with all those really bad artists on stage? I love it.
I don't agree. I really don't agree.
You don't agree with what?
I just see this as, if I wanted to buy a U2 album,
yeah,
I'd buy a U2 album. If I can save $20 on my iPod and you're going to give me a U2 album for free because, whoever a U2 album company is going to, or CD company, sorry, showing my age, is going to contribute $20, take $20 off my iPod.
Yeah.
And absolutely, I'll take, U2 CD for free and save $20. Otherwise, I go to Best Buy and buy it for $14.99.
Yeah, but you're never going to buy the device just to get the album, obviously. But the fact is that they're doing a million of these a month. At this point, we're not talking about increasing iPod sales as much as
we're talking about increasing U2 sales. That's what buying advertising on these things is all about.
Absolutely.
Is U2 going to sell more albums because they're on iPods?
Well, this turns into a rumor. You think it's going to backfire? I think if it turns out to be true, it ends up going down in the record books or the history books as the biggest hack or the biggest perversion of establishment ever. This is the ultimate in thumbing your nose at the man. Let's not only completely
define who the man is.
It's
the man in the record company.
I don't know. Somebody is getting absolutely screwed on the fact that giving away a million albums with a million iPods totally turns charts upside down. You can't count that. You can't include that. It's certainly not going to show up in the Billboard numbers, and they're not going to get credit for those sales. But the fact is that a million people have now got that content in their head. And that's huge. That's just
exactly, which is why I thought it.
And I love it.
Interesting today, and I wish I could find it. I'm clicking furiously here. I can't remember where I saw them, but there were a whole bunch of them. They were actually going to ship a CD copy of it with the iPod, which means, guess what? Shows up on Billboard album sales.
Nice. So this could turn out to be the biggest selling album of all time, period.
Try and have your cake and, at the very least, try and nibble a little bit on it.
No, we're like, trying to have your cake and shove it up somebody else's nose.
Exactly. So, why don't we ship a whole bunch of, let's ship every new one that comes out with something from, you name some old school, let's put an Elvis album on every single one of them. How many of those Elvis albums are ever actually going to see the light of day, before they just get absolutely deleted and replaced with, let's hope, Two Drunk Marketing Guys content, but something non, even close to Elvis content.
Something non-talk, non-threatening, yeah.
Well, or just not even close to YouTube content, whether it be, classical music, whether it be just absolute talk radio, whether it be whatever genre of music that is, has no interest in you too. I find that a very deceiving and very, at the same time, rather interesting way to make some hay out of something.
For sure.
And if so long as Bono and the boys, get paid, kudos to them. I don't think the record company is going to get paid for it. I think it's going to come back and bite them all in the butt later.
In how so? That sounds really intriguing. You mean like in a dot-com bubble kind of sense, or
I look at this as being an interesting experiment with a really big band, and I just don't see that content being consumed.
Sure.
I don't see it being. I foresee a whole bunch of iPod U2 albums on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in the next 2-3 weeks or whenever they come out.
Yeah.
So
eBay and PayPal make out like bandits, yeah.
I see it being a marketing success and
yes.
a sales failure. I mean, this is one of those advertising programs and marketing campaigns that people will point to in business schools in years to come and say, didn't this look like a great idea? And then, 2 days later, your economics professor is going to say what not to do with a marketing program and just point out how they went totally wrong and generated no real, financial gain out of this.
Could be.
All they did was put a million albums on the market that, they got whatever they got for them, and then they cannibalized probably at least half of them by those being sold or given away for nothing.
Sure. I'll buy that. Absolutely. So moving on. India, new broadband policy. The nutshell on that is that one of the biggest markets in the world, they're looking for telco sort of re-regulation, if you will. In other words, let's get our telecom regulatory infrastructure up to par with the rest of the world, at least the rest of the internet world. So they've got a policy in place, and surprise, surprise, it's all about the monopoly. Is this politics? Is this smart? Is this going to last? Is it even important? I don't know. My opinion, it's tough because in a market like that where you've got absolutely a huge amount of people that could be sort of turned on by this, yet so much, let's call it so many economic obstacles, coming online? Is the regulatory policy going to even... are they going to get that far, I guess, would be a good question. I don't know. What do you think?
I think as much as I really hate monopoly, and especially telco monopoly...
it's a good thing we don't have sponsors.
Exactly.
At least not telco monopoly sponsors.
Which is why, that you know, for any of you listening, you'll never do business with me. Once you get to know me, you won't ever even sign the check. The reality is that you need an incumbent, unfortunately, you need an incumbent local provider, government-supported,
sure,
to build the infrastructure that is needed in any developing market, but, I mean, in a market that has so far to develop, and I don't mean so far as in they don't have anything, and you know, but so much to develop as India does. They have the combination of, you know, vast portions of the country that don't have a telephone line, with vast portions of the country, that are just expanding at an exponential rate. That be it, for somebody to try and get independent or try and fund it on their own to build something like this out, it's not going to happen. Unfortunately, they're going to have to stick with a telco monopoly to build the infrastructure. It's going to have to be government-sponsored. The government's just going to have to be smart about this and try and learn from some of the lessons of other countries that have, you know, faltered, really. The U.S. being one of them, Canada being another one. I'd look to the Asian countries. Korea has done a reasonably decent job of, you know, sort of holding up an ILEC monopoly, but fostering growth on the fringe to service, you know, various other smaller areas. If India can do half as good a job as Korea has done and twice as good a job as Canada and the U.S. has done, I think they'll be fine.
Fair, fair. So, you know, expanding on that one bit further, there's an entire, you know, this policy has been criticized as being socialist in nature, but there's an entire school of thought, you know, by some pretty progressive capitalists, in my opinion, that are saying that the most efficient way to run a network infrastructure like the last mile is to make it government-owned entirely and run it like hydro or run it like the water supply system. You know, so maybe if that's the direction this is taken, then the Indians are actually onto something, and we may actually see something interesting there. Don't know, but you know, I'm not going to hold my breath on that one. When you
I wish them well.
Yeah, exactly. Moving on, Akamai, Videra, application delivery network. Is this just more Web 2.0 hype, web services? Crap, or is this actually useful, interesting, valuable?
Oh, God, I don't know. I've been talking about web services since, God, you and I used to work together. And, you know, I'm all about delivery at the edge of the network and get the content as close as you can to the consumer and where you can utilize that to turn it into a distributed computing network, so much the better.
Yeah.
But if all it does is just make content faster for your end user and, you know, make their whatever it is a month worthwhile and still be able to make a buck, then do it.
So I was, when I read this myself, I was surprised to even hear that Videra was still around. What have they been up to?
To be honest with you, was just about as shocked as you are.
No, who did they used to be? They were...
I don't even... Spadera, as far as I knew, was... As I remember them. And
we're going all the way back to 1999 here to a smoky...
Barely remember
a smoky patio in San Jose. What was that name of that hotel? Across the street from the convention center, right beside the place with the great food that was open past 1 o'clock.
Oh, geez, the place that used to let us smoke in there.
Yeah. The only place in the entire valley that was open at a reasonable
hour. It was Wasn't it the Hilton? Because it was a, whatever it was. It was across the street from Adobe. Oh, I can't remember.
No. I'm talking about the place where the cigar parties were.
Oh, where the cigar parties were.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that was. You know, I can't. My iBeam friends are gonna start calling me as soon as they because I'm probably. Actually, I'm guaranteed that I drank $100 worth of booze and probably spent $30 or $40 worth of cigars every night.
So that was the we were sort of early recruits into the vendors helping vendors program. So
yes,
mostly as recipients, unfortunately. But
we paid back. We did pay back. I remember rather a couple of large bills for everybody we knew came to their parties. But anyway,
yeah, like the night we had drinks with 1,500 of our closest friends at that bank.
Yeah, we rented a bank and you know brought a couple of decks of cards and. Invited 15 or 1,600 of our closest friends.
Exactly.
That's funny.
So there were guys from Speed Arab on both at cigar parties and at the casino party that we had at the bank. But like, who were they and what were they called then? I'm at a loss.
I'm at a loss too. I mean, and
this isn't the old Skycash thing, is it?
No, it's not. It's not Skycash, which became Sidera.
Right. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
I want to. Why do I think Spadera became DSL.net? But I don't know. I really don't know.
Hmm.
And it's curious to me because it was interesting today when I saw this thing. So way back in May 2002, which is really not that way back when you really think about it. You know, but talking about a deal with Spadera. I'm like, who the hell is Spadera? Isn't that a Canadian like DSL.net thing? That was DSL.ca. I don't know these guys.
Huh.
This is nobody. And it, what is kind of interesting is that who's Akamai now? Really? I mean, I have to have a couple of pretty good friends that are in decent positions at Akamai, and I know they're still there, and I know they're still doing well, but content delivery networks have become more than a little bit passe. You know, this centralized computing concept has gone away. I mean,
which would completely support their business model, though, as websites like Microsoft.com and News.com and Amazon.com and you know all of these things get bigger and bigger and bigger. They need scale, and distribution is one way of getting that scale. So.
Oh, absolutely, but I would suggest to you that the number of websites that actually need that kind of scale is shrinking, not growing.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that, but I think their scale requirements are getting bigger, so the amount of absolute dollars in the market are probably staying roughly the same or growing slightly.
I would think that, yeah, growing sideways at best. When you think of the number of people in 1999 that thought they were going to be huge and therefore had to buy a big Akamai contract, or you know 2000, even 2001,
right,
that you know had to do a deal with Akamai or someone, that just have realized that they don't. I mean, who needs to do a deal with Akamai really? You know, absolutely, Amazon needs a significant amount of bandwidth. A significant amount of hardware backing it up.
Sure.
Is that an Akamai solution? Probably. Maybe. I don't know. I'm not. You know, I don't want to, you know, post for somebody here or not. You know, eBay needs it. You know, Tipcow has. You know, we had our own back in '97. You know, we beat Akamai by a couple 3 years. How many beyond that? Microsoft. Well, yeah, they can buy into a content distribution network, or they can just, you know, buy a big honking pipe load of bandwidth and essentially own a huge co-location facility, which is what they do, and just pull pipes in from everywhere.
Sure. You know, I guess it's like any enterprise player. You're dealing with the Fortune 500. There's only 500 of those companies, and that's your market. And the great thing
about
that.
And you're not even dealing with the Fortune 500.
It's a small number, and they pay through the nose. So as long as there's the Fortune 500 of the websites or you know, the top 100 or whatever you want to call it, as long as they've got a crap load of money because they're all successful, then, you know, who cares if it's past A or not, as long as it's paying the bills and you got some growth ahead of you, right?
I think you're dealing with the Web 100 primarily, the Fortune 500 on an extended basis.
Sure.
And, you know, yeah, I don't know, but, you know, we all know what really drives traffic on the internet. Still.
It's well, porn.
So, you know, so Neil has had it nailed down, what, 7 years ago now.
Yeah, but he was stating the obvious at that point.
You know, he was stating the obvious at that point, and everybody's trying to get away from it, but the reality of it is that it's still the same business.
Yeah. I actually had to laugh a couple of weeks ago. I saw the, I don't know if you saw it or not, but Feedster made an announcement about the sort of the content discovery attributes of the Feedster blog search mechanism. It's like, oh, so what people are finding is, oh, is that you can use Feedster to search for porn. Excellent. This is completely means that web blogs and RSS have reached a tipping point. I just couldn't help myself but to think about that night Saturday where Jason standing on the table extolling the virtues of porn.
for those who weren't there, I Neil and Funk care. We sat around and Jason got rather inebriated that evening, and we all did. He was just particularly inebriated, and he just sort of stood up and pointed at everybody and says, I don't care what you say. I'll look at your log. We're all in the prawn business. It just doesn't matter. And sat back down, and everybody sort of stopped for a second and thought, oh, yeah, last time I checked the log, yeah, we were in the porn business, weren't we?
Exactly.
That was what was driving the vast majority of all of the web traffic. Now, you look at that.
And email, the Usenet traffic and the email traffic.
The Usenet traffic is almost all porn. It wasn't. It at that point, MP3s were just starting to come into fruition. I mean, you know, the multi-part binaries were porn movies. They weren't, you know, MP3s even then.
What was the big joke there? Not in 97, but in 98 at ISPCon about MP3s. What did the acronym stand for?
I don't know.
Megapipe cubed. That's what it was.
Yeah, megapipe cubed. That's it. And it was funny because I mean I vividly remember, you know, meetings at Two Cows when we were talking about launching a music site. And there were some people that recommended strenuously against it. I was one of them. When I said, you know, look, I mean, I deal with these guys every day. As soon as you say MP3 to them, they think Big Ben with Bill.
Yeah.
They're not going to host our music site. Trust me, they're not going to host our music site. This is not a good idea. And, you know, as it turned out, the RIAA can't kind of, you know, had a little bit to do with it.
Jumped in front of that argument.
You know, and it just, I'm not quite sure whether I was right or they just, you know.
For the casual listener, I'm not referring to any specific RIA encounters, but just the general, the kibosh they put on the entire industry back then when they started doing guys like Michael Roberts and Napster and on and on and on and on. It was just generally seen that having anything to do with MP3s in your business plan wasn't really, really adding to your chances of success. So that's the whole thing there. Just let anybody get the wrong impression. But anyway, carry on. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I don't have to live in that world anymore, so I don't even think about that stuff anymore.
I have a day job and I like it.
Yeah, and trust me, that was not specifically. There was nothing in there that I was talking about.
Of course.
But content distribution networks, isn't that, you know, just a glorified version of RSS? Like, hasn't RSS just sort of simplified all of that?
Well, I've always thought of it as a way to simply outsource one step further. So, in other words, I don't want to build my own NOC in 40 countries to get my content. I don't want to rent space in a NOC in 40 countries to get my content around. Why don't I just outsource my content delivery stuff to guys like Akamai, who got presences in X countries and have these NOCs built and actually have servers there, and this is all they do. So to me, it's just another spin on the whole outsourcing thing, as opposed to some neat new technology or mechanism. And it's certainly the case that our RSS applications can benefit from some of that distribution, but I don't really see it as similar. You know, correct, I might be wrong, but
I just look at more and more people that think that really have no need for anything even approaching what you or I think, specifically I, would consider a content distribution network.
Sure.
When you start, unless you're talking about pushing gigabytes and gigabytes a day, what do you need a content distribution network for?
Because you got to keep the overly cautious IT guys happy and the overly aggressive marketers marketing. And you might be describing the classic enterprise dynamic there.
No, you need to keep the overly cautious IT guys innovating and the overly aggressive marketing guys marketing. And distribution is distribution. This is not an issue anymore of how much pipe is there. I mean, whether it's P2P networks, which I'm not a big fan of, but it'll get out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, as much as I actually like Akamai, and I do believe in what they do, and they have a quality service, don't get me wrong, I just don't think that they are for as many people as a lot of the people think that they're, you know, well, we better go sign up with Akamai because we need this.
Sure.
I don't think they need that. I really don't. I think that they just need a better, actually, what I really think they need is better marketing to get it into more hands, to get it distributed.
Maybe.
More widely.
I wouldn't go that far. I think that they're doing a great job at defending a pretty small market, and I think that they're going to continue to clean up. I don't know if it can support any more than two, maybe three players. You know, we've certainly seen a bunch of people try and bump up against them, but at the end of the day, these guys do a great job, and their customers are obviously pretty happy because you don't see a ton of new entrants and you don't see a ton of churn, and you know, it's generally, like you said, a pretty quiet and passive thing. So,
at the end of the day, I think these guys are the best in the market, and anybody else that's in it should start looking for something else to do, and anybody that's thinking about getting into it really should think about something else.
Damn it. Moving on. Let's talk about trade shows.
Okay.
Now, you used to be like the trade show king, at least in the circles I traveled in, which were admittedly somewhat tight.
Rather narrow. Yeah.
Rather narrow, exactly. But I met you, I first met you at a trade show, and at least first the early years we knew each other, probably spent most of our time together at a trade show. Cut a link on Doc Searle's weblog to the Cheap Bastard Guide to the Technical Trade Show. What did you think of that?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things that, you know, that I could probably disagree with, and we could probably, you know, the author and I could argue to the bitter end and then agree to disagree on. But, yeah, the amount of money spent on trade shows, particularly by companies that, you know, really can't afford it, is I've seen more companies, and you and I have both seen them. I mean, we lived through the dot bomb, and we saw it first. You know, the amount of money spent by our friends at Ivy.
We got scars, damn it!
You know, like I said, I mean, I kid you not, I drank $100 worth of booze and smoked $40 worth of cigars at each one of their parties, and I bet I went to 10 of them.
And that's not because they were handing out really good cigars either.
No. You know, I just smoked a lot of cigars.
Exactly.
I got to know the guys, and, you know, they
would... gave the liquor and a case of cigars.
And what a waste of money.
Yeah.
You know.
And, in fairness, they were actually one of the more responsible, conservative ones, at least in those party circles. Look at, quick, name the guys that rented the Baltimore Aquarium in 98. And where are they now?
They're out of business.
Yeah.
It was a browser
customization
company. Snap, I believe it was.
Nope.
Wasn't it?
Not Snap.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
They're out of business too. So.
And how much did it cost them for that party?
Last I heard was $250,000.
Try $1 million.
$1 million.
$1 million.
Do you have any idea how much money I could have made for them with $1 million?
Just in interest alone.
Exactly. We could still be in business. I could support. If I'd invested wisely, I could still have a staff of five from that $1 million. Because that was like 98 or 99.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, just the amount of money that is wasted at these events is kind of mind-boggling.
So,
actually,
so,
and I look at some of the stupid things that we did that cost us nothing that I used to get crap for.
Right.
That just gained us notoriety. I mean, certainly, you know, assuming that more than you and I are listening to this, but certainly somebody who went to a trade show in like the year 1999 or 2000, because they were in both years, where I just sort of went solo to these events and spoke at them, somebody walked into a bathroom somewhere and looked into the mirror when they were washing their hands and saw a Tuco sign on the mirror at somebody else's party, no doubt.
Oh, that's right.
It really didn't matter whether you were in the ladies' room or the men's room.
I'd forgotten about that. We were looking for cheap sponsorship.
$329 Canadian.
We actually had to invent a new sponsorship class to rent, to literally sponsor the washrooms. I'd forgotten about that. And that allowed us to go and put stickers on the mirrors, didn't it?
$329 Canadian. I still remember it to the day because I got pushback and pushback and pushback to my $329 Canadian dollar expense to buy 250 of these. What are now standard, you see them in the backs of everybody's car windows.
Yeah.
Those inside the window stickers, well, that's all they were. We just printed them in reverse as opposed to printing them in reverse. So that they shone back from the mirror and you could read them. And as soon as I started sticking them on places, people started hearing about them and girls would come up to me and say, I heard you got these stickers in the men's room. Yeah. Why don't we have any in the ladies' room? And I said, because I didn't bring any ladies with me. Well, do you have any? Absolutely. Here you go. And I'd send girls into the girls' washroom that I didn't even know. With, you know, four or five stickers, they'd stick them on all the mirrors and come back and say, done.
Perfect.
Perfect. You know, and people would ask me, how did you get them into the ladies' room? You're the only person here and you're a guy. How did you get, like, did you sneak in there? You know, gentleman doesn't tell was my line. And these women would just literally volunteer to stick them on the ladies' mirrors because...
Yeah. What was the 40 by 40 booth going for back then?
It was, I want to say, about $200 a square foot. Plus.
Yeah.
Like, you could, if you bought a 40 by 40, you could get it for as cheap as $200 a square foot. But then, you know, by the time they added all of that onto it, you were looking at an astronomical amount of money. And the worst part of it was, and that's the part of trade shows that people never actually take into consideration. They see booth space and they say, well, that's a bargain. No, we could get a 10 by 10 for $2,000. That's a reasonable deal. Look at the attendance. And then when you realize what else you've got to spend to get people to wherever and house them and feed them and pay them and lose productivity, you know, that $2,000 becomes, you know, $15,000.
Sure.
In most cases, really, really quickly.
Yeah.
And you haven't given anything away. You haven't done any real promotional work around it. You haven't done any of your own marketing, which, you know, costs you money. So you spend $20,000 not knowing if you're going to get a dime back. I mean, how many shows, there's very few shows that are done, you know, from a 10 by 10 booth that generate $20,000 in profit.
Yeah, so you you walk in, trim $29 with the stickers. What did the sponsorship cost you? Like, how much did you pay for the show, for the washroom?
It seems to me that I'm trying to remember how a lot of these things went. It seems to me we mostly did it in co-op media sponsorships.
Okay.
because we owned a lot of media at the time, and we, you know, we had a really influential customer base at the time. But let's say it cost us, $1,000. Let's just pretend
it cost us $1,000.
I don't think it cost us half that, but let's say it cost us $1,000, and my trip for one person, there and back, hotel and everything in, cost us another $1,000.
So for $2,300, we're talking Canadian dollars, so it was like $14 U.S. How many sales?
Back then it was about a buck and a half.
Yeah,
but anyway.
True. So and how many sales did you close off that? Do you remember?
It's hard to say, but I bet I would feel confident to say that we did $20,000 worth of business off of those. I mean, I did two or three of those shows, and I bet we did $20,000 off each one.
Fair. Fair. So you're looking at
conservatively,
5-to-1 return on investment. The 10-to-1 is not out of the question.
Somewhere between 5 and 10-to-1 over a 12 to 24 month period.
You know what?
I mean, if I could walk into a client right now, I mean, cause this is kind of what I do for a living, and if I could say I can get you, you know, a 5-to-1 return on your investment over the next 24 years or 24 months, sorry, they would jump up and down at me, and you know, they ask me what body part I want to get. If I could promise that. And you can't, because you can't. But the reality of it is that trade shows are such a waste of money. They really are such a waste of money.
So what would you have added to this guide? What was missing?
It talked about sending a sales engineer and sending a technical guy.
The chief guy and the technical guy, if I remember correctly.
And if the chief guy is you, you know, you got to send two guys that can sell.
Yeah.
And you got to send two guys that understand the ebb and flow of business at a trade show.
What's that mean?
You meet people on the trade show floor. You close business off the floor.
Oh, yeah, the hangover part. I forgot about that.
Well, not even the hangover part. Since I know that Elliot actually is probably going to listen to this, you know.
Well, it's the productive part. That's right. For those of you that don't know, Elliot's my boss.
There was a fair amount of business that came as a result of Ross and I being able to, you know, drink later into the evening than a good number of the other people. But, you know, the reality of it was is that the relationships that are built to trade shows, I mean, the real value of a trade show is the ability to stand there literally toe-to-toe with your customer or your prospect and address their concerns. And have people that are there that are smart enough to say, you know what, I don't have a solution to your problem. I just don't. Or people that are smart enough to recognize that, you know what, this guy's business is not going to be worth the hassle that it's going to entail. The smartest thing that comes from trade shows, in my opinion, is the customers you don't get.
Sure. I hate to cut you off, Doug, but I just got my 2-minute warning. My phone beeped at me saying, dude, your battery's going to die. So we got to pick this up. Not to mention, we've been talking now for, we're going into hour 2 here. So,
what's going to be edited down to considerably less than this?
I doubt it, actually. I think we'll see. We'll see what happens. But next week?
Absolutely.
Perfect. So that two drunk marketing guys, which is now just too old and slightly cynical and not knowing near as much as they thought they once did, marketing guys, and actually only one of us is really truly a marketing guy anymore. So this is us. Sonny, I'm Ross.
I'm Doug.
Talk to you next week.
Good night.
Thank you. I saw a rainbow light up in my mind. And something from the beginning to the end. You've actually got, you have basically two different kinds of music. Even though it's a lot of electronics. So the rainbow is starting with the one kind of music and moving into the other. Does that make sense to you?
So that was Too Drunk Marketing, guys. Hopefully it was I wouldn't say enlightening, and certainly interesting isn't the word that I'm looking for. Hopefully you found that entertaining experience in some weird, twisted, warped way. Like I said, it is what it is. It was fun doing it. We're going to work on making it better. And if you have any ideas on how we can make it better, I definitely want to hear. You can leave a comment on my weblog at www.byte.org, byte.org. God, that almost sounds like college, doesn't it? Drop me an email, ross@2cows.com. If you don't want to use my work address, which may not be always appropriate, you can use my home address. Like, I've got one. ross@2cows.com. Had the same one for the last 10 years. I may have, actually, a home address lying around someplace. When I signed up for my DSL, I think they gave me one. That's probably where they're sending the bill. There's actually a funny story there. That they did send bills there for two whole years. During that time, my credit card had changed. Got a new credit card. So the old one had expired. And they weren't able to bill my account anymore. Bill my credit card. So rather than cutting me off like any normal utility would, they just kept giving me service and didn't bill me at all for 2 years. And then one day they decided that they were going to get tough on all their deadbeat clients that they were unable to successfully bill, and sent me this nasty note saying that I had 2 days to pay, 48 hours to pay for 2 years worth of service. Now you do the math, 24 months, $50 a month. It's a big number. So I wasn't going to pay them. Forget it. There was no way that I was, you know, they're bad. I wasn't coughing up, and I certainly wasn't going out for no service. Anyways, after an hour on the phone and ranting and raving this and that, they settled out for about $350 Canadian, which was a pretty good deal. So yeah, they definitely did give me an email account. I haven't checked it since, but they have me on a pre-auth plan now. So they're bypassing the credit cards, going straight to where the real money is. That's got to be enough out of me for this week. I do have one final track lined up for you. This one's by Kim Fowley and Buzzy Beano. It's called Crimson Seagull. And if it's late, this one's got some harps, and it's about birds, and hopefully it's enough to put you to sleep. Anyways, thanks for listening. You made an investment this week. 90 minutes by the looks of it on the count here. I appreciate it. Enjoy the track. I'm out of here.
J'ai chaud dans le soleil de l'automne.
Chose. Il y a longtemps depuis j'ai joué.